This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If a rainy walk in the woods sounds like a nice spring day to you, you are in good company. Later this hour, we'll talk with experts in foraging about wild edibles like fiddleheads, ramps, and mushrooms that can be found at this time of year. And you can tell us what you forage for by emailing vermontedition@vpr.net. But first today, an update on the controversial measure at the State House to make Vermont's rules around childhood vaccines stricter by removing one of three legal exemptions. Large crowds on both sides of the debate were at the State House last night in a hearing and giving public testimony on the philosophical exemption.
I'm here today just to simply ask for a choice. I support the philosophical exemption.
I don't think that this is a choice issue. I think this is a public health issue.
My daughter is fully vaccinated according to the required schedule, but I do not think other parents should be forced to vaccinate their children in order to protect my child further and the herd.
Philosophical exemption just makes it somebody else's problem and allows you to pretend that you're protecting your children.
Back in 1986, the federal government acknowledged that vaccines may be unavoidably unsafe through the creation of the National Vaccine Injury Act. And I firmly believe that where there is risk, there must be choice.
Anyone who has been in the trenches and has seen what I've seen and what most physicians have seen at some point in their training would never believe that the infinitesimally low risk of vaccination is worth the risk of these diseases.
The state of Vermont forcing us to vaccinate our daughter against our best judgment would be a textbook example of excessive government involvement in what should be a private family health decision.
Vermont's immunization rates are too low. They're last in New England. And in many corners of the state, they're dangerously low. We need to act before it's too late.
Those are just a few of the voices from last night's two-hour hearing, which VPR's Peter Hirschfeld attended. And Pete joins us now. Hi there, Pete.
Hey, Jane.
So this issue was debated in previous years, and lawmakers chose to keep the exemption in place. Can you remind us why the issue has resurfaced with such a firestorm this year?
Well, let's flash back to December when a measles outbreak that was eventually traced to Disneyland sickened almost 150 people nationwide. It was a high-profile event that focused a lot of scrutiny on this philosophical exemption that exists in 19 states and the role that this exemption plays in the spread of vaccine-preventable diseases. It served to reignite a debate that had been in the State House 3 years ago when lawmakers ultimately decided not to eliminate the exemption.
Okay, so given that and given the sort of public scrutiny this is under, we should talk a little bit about public health policy. It's really a mix of health and medical advice and politics. So sketch out the landscape specifically in Vermont on this issue.
You know, it's one of those issues that just sucks the oxygen out of the room in Montpelier. The constituencies leading either side of the fight on this are not huge numbers-wise, but they're incredibly intense, as we saw on display at this public hearing, and they've really mobilized. I mean, people have swamped legislators' inboxes and voicemails with pleas for and against the elimination of this exemption. House Speaker Shaq Smith does not want to have to deal with this controversy again in 2016, and it's for that reason that he's really pushing so hard to get this proposal to the floor this year. The Democrats aren't hugely politically invested in the outcome of this vote. There's no caucus position. They aren't twisting arms heavily, at least, for votes for getting rid of the exemption. They just want to get this done one way or another and be done with it for as many years as possible.
You know, Pete, it's interesting you say the Democrats have no caucus position on this, but certainly many politicians have been asked about this over the years and this year in particular. And Governor Peter Shumlin is one who's made a change in his position recently.
You know, it's tough to track exactly where the governor comes down on this. He says, look, I don't believe the science that says these vaccines are dangerous. I think every parent should get their kids vaccinated fully. But yet, he doesn't feel like it's government's place to tell them that they have to do so. Asked whether this sort of dissonance in his position means that he wouldn't sign a bill if it came to his desk getting rid of the philosophical exemption, he so far refused to say. He's explained this, you know, underscored his belief in the importance of these vaccines while simultaneously saying that it's not government's place to force parents to get them. So he's going to have to make a decision which of those he prioritizes more if indeed this thing does make it to his desk.
Pete, for all the talk about this issue, the Senate bill that was sponsored by Kevin Mullen and John Campbell seemed to be going nowhere for the most of the winter, and then suddenly it's added to another bill and it passes.
This is a direct consequence of that broader public conversation that we saw arise in the wake of that measles outbreak. John Campbell and Kevin Mullen felt strongly about this 3 years ago. They feel strongly about it today, too. And they saw an opportunity to use that episode as a springboard for something that they could not get through the House in 2012. Remember, there are a lot of new faces in this building since the last time lawmakers had this debate, and that outbreak combined also with testimony in favor of eliminating the exemption from Commissioner of Health Harry Chen has had an impact on the way people view the issue.
Pete, we played a little montage of sound of some of the voices at last night's hearing in the House chamber attended by several hundred people. This morning, the House Health and Welfare Committee took up the issue with all of that added testimony. You've been sitting in on the committee's proceedings today. How did last night's events impact what's been happening today?
Jaded political reporters tend to dismiss public hearings as a political theater put on to provide the illusion that lawmakers' opinions have been shaped by the will of their constituents. And this has been, I have to say, a refreshing incident of a public hearing actually having an impact on the way people feel about this in the building. That's not to say it's for the good or bad, one way or the other, but on their drive homes last night, there are legislators who felt one way about this going in and feel differently about it now, not the least of whom is Representative Bill Lippert, who's the chairman of the House Committee on Healthcare. He said, you know, I was driving home. I had this revelation that we are not prepared to make this decision this year in this body. That's a real reversal from the position that he had literally 24 hours ago when he said this was the year to make it happen.
Well, given that he says this committee is not prepared to make this decision right now, is it going to get out of committee and get to the House floor?
It doesn't matter. You know, the committee process in this instance isn't necessary to see this issue come to the floor. There are a lot of procedural maneuvers that the House has been able to use to ensure that there will be a floor vote this year. The question is, does this reluctance from a guy as prominent as Bill Lippert, from people as prominent as some of the other members of this House Healthcare Committee, change the way in which their colleagues feel about this? There are people on either side that feel very strongly. They know how they're going to vote. But there are a lot of people in the middle that don't know what to make of all this. They're looking for a leader. They're looking for guidance. Question is, will they look to a guy like Bill Lippert for it, or will they look to somebody like, say, medical doctor George Till, who's going to urge them strongly to support the elimination of this exemption?
And, Pete, do you have any sense of what the outcome might be then?
It is going to hinge on a very few votes. There are top Democrats in this building who say it could be anywhere as low as 70 votes in support of eliminating the exemption. That would not be enough to get it done, or as high as 80. We'll find out soon.
That's VPR State House reporter Peter Hirschfeld updating us on a bill that could eliminate Vermont's philosophical exemption for childhood vaccines. Pete, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Jane.
Continue to follow VPR for all of the news on this bill as it moves to the House floor. We will keep you updated. You can find all of that at vpr.net or right here on the radio. Coming up, ramps, fiddleheads, and morels. Oh, my. We'll talk about how to forage for your own dinner and offer some suggestions for a really delicious dish. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. A walk in the woods at this time of year can be a delicious excursion. Ramps, fiddleheads, and pheasantback mushrooms have emerged with the spring weather and are ready for harvesting. Morels are not far behind, maybe even available where you live already. So your dinner tonight could be augmented by wild edible plants if you play your cards right. But people are pretty secretive about their good foraging spots, partly perhaps out of greed, but also because these plants and fungi can be over-harvested, and foragers are, or should be, sensitive to that. For the next half hour, we're going to talk about what kinds of locales you should be looking in if you're looking for these delicious finds, and we'll find out how to cook and eat them to get the most out of their flavors. So listeners, if you have questions, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or if you want to tell us how you cook up your fiddleheads, what you do with ramps, do you pickle them? Do you make kimchi out of them? You can post your favorite thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And we're joined now by David Hugo, head chef and food services director at Shelburne Farms. David, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And also with us is Robert Resnick, foraging enthusiast and one of the state's top experts on mushrooms. VPR listeners know him, of course, as the host of the folk music show All the Traditions here on VPR. Hi, Robert.
Which way to the morels?
Yes, I know you're very excited about morels. And also, you are the one who gave me the fabulous idea of ramp kimchi. So we're going to get into that as
boy,
well.
Oh, boy.
All right. So let's talk first about what we can actually find at this time of year. Fiddleheads, ramps, pheasant back mushrooms. Anything else that you guys are seeing out there, David?
There's a little bit of trout lilies, we call them.
Yeah, I didn't know you could eat trout lilies.
You can in small amounts. They're great for you. They have a really great flavor also.
Do you eat the flower or the leaves?
The leaves, yeah, and definitely. So just crumble them up, put them in a salad.
And the trout lilies, the reason that they are called trout lilies, I think, is because those leaves are speckled, like the speckled trout.
Yeah, it looks just like a trout.
And Robert, what are you going for these days?
Well, the ramps are up. The fiddleheads are almost gone by already. And I was just thinking the violets are out. If you like candied violets as a decoration and as a yummy little nibble, they're really, really good. And according to my calculations, morels are approximately 48 hours away.
You laugh, but that's kind of true, right?
It really is. Well, I've been looking for them for about 27 years now, and they always appear within a couple of days of May 17th.
Wow.
And every year. There have been a couple of years where it have been about a week or two earlier than that, but for the most part, it's right around that time, and then for another 3 weeks afterwards.
All right. So while we're talking about mushrooms, for people who maybe are just getting into this or don't have their favorite spots, let's talk about where you might go to find some of these things. So you just mentioned morels and pheasant back mushrooms. Can you talk a little bit about where you might find both of those kinds?
Well, first of all, morels love disturbed ground. For the most part, they are rats deserting a sinking ship, which means that the tree that the mushroom has a relationship with is usually sick, dead, dying, or bothered in some way, shape, or form. And when the trees are apparently send out a signal, and then the mushrooms themselves that we're talking about are basically like fruits on the tree, and they appear to spread the spores. And usually it happens that the mushrooms are available for a couple of seasons, and then they're gone. And that's one of the reasons why morels make people crazy. I call them the great equalizer, because as soon as you think you know what you're doing with mushroom hunting, just hunt morels. They like disturbed ground, which means barbed wire, broken glass, salt damage, stuff along the side of highways, ridiculous steep spots. And sometimes they just come up in wood chips spontaneously to fool you. And it's just a great learning experience every year. Now, pheasant backs, you mentioned that's Polyporous squamosus.
Of course, everybody knew that.
Well, it's so funny because I was originally a forestry major, and then I dropped out because I didn't think I could survive dendrology. And now I've got all these mushroom, these Linnaean names in my head. But anyway, that mushroom, which is also called the dryad saddle and the pheasant back, grows on elm trees when they're too far gone to foster morels. So we used to call it, the joke find. But the nice thing about them is if you find them when they're soft and tender and new, they're really pretty delicious by themselves. Or you can cut them up in little squares and you can deep fry them and make like a wild mushroom gorp out of them. It's really delicious.
Mm, that sounds fabulous. And we're going to get deeper into some of the ways to cook with these in a little while. David Hugo, maybe you could talk a little bit about fiddleheads. If they're not quite gone yet in people's areas, where might they find them?
I find along rivers. You find them quite well. So along Lewis Creek, La Platte River.
These are Chittenden County and Chittenden County areas.
Addison County areas. But walk along a river.
I found a lot of them along the Ottauquechee. down south.
Okay.
So, I mean, they just like, they like damp. They like lots of sunlight. And you can't miss them. The problem is, when you really can't miss them, is when they're 4 feet high and they're way past the spot.
Yeah, you want to get them when they are those tightly curled fiddleheads, not when the ferns have unfurled their fronds.
Absolutely.
We're talking today about foraging because, gosh, after last winter, aren't you just so glad that you can go out and find anything outside, and let alone something that you could eat for dinner and impress your friends with? If you have a question or if you want to share your favorite tips for finding wild edibles at this time of year or what you do with them when you get them home, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Forrest is lucky. He says, we have an acre of ramps behind my house. Boy, that doesn't take much to do then if you just have to go out behind your house. And let's bring another voice in here. Arthur Haynes is a research botanist for the New England Wildflower Society and head of the Delta Institute of Natural History in Canton, Maine. On May 30th, he'll be leading a class on how to identify, harvest, and prepare wild plants found in central Vermont at the Vermont Institute of Natural Science Nature Center in Queechee. And he joins us on the phone now. Hello, Arthur.
Hi there. Thanks for inviting me to be part of your program.
Well, we're happy to have you. And Forrest mentioned that he just has to go out behind his house to find ramps. Where might other people go?
Well, ramps, or wild leeks, as they're often called, are a species of very rich, moist soils. And they're often found along river terraces that are infrequently flooded. Or they're found on very steep, rocky hillsides where you'd find trees like sugar maple and American linden and white ash.
So we've now mentioned fiddleheads, ramps, a couple different kinds of mushrooms. David Hugo mentioned trout lilies. Are there other things that you're out seeking that you eat at this time of year?
Yeah, really it's too many to list, but I'll give you just a few of the ones that we go after in abundance. And some of them are non-native and, you know, sort of aggressively invasive plants that we're out foraging, like the shoots of Japanese knotweed and the young shoots of Dame's Rocket, which is a mustard. But we're also eating some native species, too, like Carolina Spring Beauty and, as mentioned, trout lily when those things grow in abundance.
So, Arthur, when it comes to something that's invasive, the prevailing idea is you can just harvest the heck out of that because it's an invasive species. Many of these people are trying to get rid of altogether, so it doesn't matter how careful you are about preserving some of them for next season. Other things, though, like fiddleheads and ramps, you need to be more careful about. And is there a rule of thumb in terms of how much you should harvest from any patch?
There. Unfortunately, the sort of blanket rules of thumbs that just get applied to plants across the board don't always work for some of the species that we're really interested in. To give you a good example, there's been some research done showing that if you were to harvest one-tenth of the bulbs from a ramp population, that level of collection would only be sustainable once every 10 years. And so with some of these species, we need to make sure that we're taking incredibly small amounts of the underground parts, or better, what we're trying to encourage people to do here in Maine, where wild leeks are less common than they are in Vermont, is to simply take one of the leaves. Each plant sends up a couple of two, three leaves, sometimes more. And we can harvest the leaf from these plants without harming them, and we still get to enjoy them in soups and salads and all kinds of other cooking.
So that means if you're just harvesting the leaves, David Hugo, that you can't, for example, pickle the bulbs of the ramps. What do you do with leaves?
You can make grape purees with them. Pestos work really well. Pureeing them in soup work really well. Even just putting them into salads, just cutting them up and putting them in, tossing them into your salads is great.
And Robert, now we have to get to the kimchi because you made ramp kimchi this year.
Yeah, I did. Well, I've made it. I made it last year for the first time, and some of my Asian friends that tried it said that it was the best kimchi they ever had in their lives. And you know, I mean, that was enough to inspire me to keep, you know, going after it. And I've been doing this one leaf at a time routine. And came back to my ramp patch about 2 weeks later, and they were just fine. You know, the remaining leaves looked healthy and everything. It wasn't like one of those. Sometimes with mushrooms, if you pick a mushroom, you can kind of infect the mycelium down below if you're not careful. So you have to be careful about how you pick something. There's a lot of stuff in this business, especially with mushrooms, that the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. But back to ramp kimchi. What you basically do is you take the leaves of ramps and you spread them out and you smear them with a lovely paste of shrimp paste and onions and sesame seeds and hot peppers. You don't need garlic because it's garlicky enough as it is. And after about 2 weeks in the refrigerator, it starts to get wonderful. And about 4 weeks in the refrigerator, it gets transcendently wonderful.
So you're a refrigerator kimchi maker, not a bury the kimchi maker.
I actually talked to a friend of mine who does that. And in fact, they left some of their ramp kimchi out to hurry it up, and it came out bitter.
Huh.
So I can't speak for anything else except my own experience, but so far I'm a refrigerator guy.
We got a note from Judah who says, when I was a kid, I used to love foraging for fiddleheads and all sorts of nuts, berries, and birch bark for tea and such. But lately, with all the spraying of waste on fields and the runoff into rivers and brooks, not to mention the spray that travels all over in the air, even the thought of supermarket produce makes me a bit queasy. Arthur Haynes, what is the risk, if any, of picking in an area that might be polluted or picking on the roadside?
Well, it really, again, depends on exactly what plant you're talking about and even what toxin you're talking about. And if we keep this discussion on ramps, because that's one of the things that people are really excited about right now, ramps do grow along some of our major rivers, which are places where paper mills and other factories have discharged things like dioxins and PCBs and other things that are pretty potent endocrine disruptors and set us up for a risk of cancer. The real benefit to us in terms of how these chemicals work in the plant is they tend to accumulate in the bulbs, and they're not translocated to the aerial portions of the plant. In other words, the leaves are nearly free of these compounds, whereas the bulbs might be toxic for you to consume from the wrong river system. So it's another reason why just consuming the leaves, meaning just picking the leaves, is really advantageous. It's not just for the plant, but also for your health.
David, I think you have a salad on the menu at the Inn at Shelburne Farms that's a foraged salad, right, or a wild edible salad. Do people ever have qualms about that? I mean, it seems like perhaps long, long ago, obviously that was the method of getting food, but these days do people want to know? Yes, but I want to know exactly where it came from and make sure that it's safe.
Well, people do ask that question, where they come from, and usually we're foraging them, or I pick foragers that know what they're doing. So I've never found that, really.
People concerned about it. We got a question from Benjamin, who's on the road here from Alabama. And Benjamin says, when you're looking at fiddleheads, is there a way to tell how one fiddlehead will taste compared to another? David, do you look at them and have a sense of which is going to go best in the pot or in the
salad? You know what? I have a pastry chef, and we were discussing that today, and she was thinking that the fiddleheads taste a little bit off this year. I'm not sure if it's where they were harvested that she ate or not.
But you can't look at one and see that that's going to taste better than another.
No, I also, if it's in a muddy area or the smell is off, you have to kind of look around and see where you're picking them. But just pick a clean spot, and if it smells a little off, the mud's a little off, definitely the taste could be definitely off.
Talking about wild edibles today, you can share your questions or your recipes. Come on now, I want some good recipes. You can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Jim's on the line from Randolph. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hello. This is Jim at Cajun Moon Farm. I'm standing here at the sink cleaning about 10 pounds of ramps.
That's a lot of ramps.
Lucky you, yeah.
Coincidentally, by the way, we do a little exchange business with a place called Vermont Commons down in Okemo, and they bring in chefs from all over the country. So we have a chef coming in to visit the farm this evening, and this is going to be his first exposure to ramps.
That sounds wonderful.
Some recipes. Lemon, sea salt, lemon, olive oil, you can do either fresh, tossed, or that into a pesto with the ramps for that. And I tend to separate, I'm separating right now ramps into three categories for them. The really tiny ones with the really soft leaves. I like to eat the leaves raw in that size. So that's my chime in on ramps. I had a question on morels, because some years are easy and some years are obviously hard. What's your experience with possibly undisturbed areas in old apple orchards in relation to that and mature ash trees? And what's your experience as far as morels at elevation, say, 1,300, 1,400 feet and up?
Jim, thanks for the call. Robert Resnick?
Well, I've found them everywhere. I've found them mocking me, one, under an apple tree, you know. I've heard of stories of people finding hundreds of them in old Christmas tree farms that have just been dropped. I've seen them growing huge ones in softwoods. And so I think that, you know, the real secret, if somebody really, really wants to find morels, is you've got to cover a lot of ground in the next 12 or 14 days. That's really what you've got to have the luxury of the time to do that and to really wander. And that is my best advice. And I think that, you know, as Cadillac Jack says, anything can be anywhere. And I do believe that. I think in this case, as long as there's rain, the last couple of days have been like mushroomers heaven weather. It's just what we want, which is, you know, nice soft soaking rains and kind of medium warm temperature. It's just the best.
I've never gone out looking for morels, so I don't know exactly what they even look like or whether I could get them confused with another mushroom.
There is a mushroom called Gyromitra esculenta, which is the false morel, which in my experience comes out 8 to 10 days before the regular morels appear in the Champlain Valley. And they have the same kind of thick, fleshy stalk, but the top, one of the things that they always say about real morels, which is Morchella esculenta, is you cut it in half and it's hollow. It's completely hollow. Whereas a lot of the other ones, the Verpas, the Helvellas, the ones that are related to the morels in some way and often come up around the same time, is that they usually have either kind of a brainy, kind of a confused interior, let me put it that way. And I have to say that with some of them, false morels, for instance, are particularly dangerous because they're toxic unless cooked. And if you cook them and you breathe in the fumes as they're coming out of the pan, you're getting a full dose of what will kill you. And it's one of those ones that has no bad effects, no bad effects, no bad effects. And the fourth or fifth time, you're done. So it's enough to really make you pay attention. But the good news is, you know, if you really find morels, either black morels or esculenta, which is more of a flesh color, is pretty much no question what you found.
Okay. And David, I want to ask you about cooking them. But before we do, Joe in Rockingham wants to have a recommendation for a mushroom book with photos to get started on safe foraging. Arthur Haynes, do you have any advice on what books people might be able to get?
Well, there's a number of books that cover the area. The thing that people need to remember with mushroom books is they're rarely comprehensive. In other words, they don't include all the mushrooms. So I always encourage people to have multiple books on mushrooms, and those might include David Aurora's Mushrooms Demystified for people that are a little bit more skilled. And, of course, there's an Audubon and a Peterson guide to mushrooms that can be helpful. And one that I actually enjoy that, of course, everyone will have their own opinion, is a book by Miller and Miller called North American Mushrooms. But those are the four that I tend to use, and I try to confirm the mushrooms' identifications in all of those four references to make sure the mistakes are not being made.
Robert?
There is another book that was partially authored by Gary Linkoff, who's the guy that wrote the Audubon book, and I believe the other author's name is Laso. And what I really like about that book is that the photographs are exquisite. It's really in the old days, you used to always go for hand-drawn illustrations because they were more accurate. That is no longer the case in my experience. There's just been some amazing books out in the last 15 years. And the most important thing is to find a book that you're comfortable with to use as kind of a base thing. And then to cross-check as much as you possibly can, and even better yet, to cross-check with somebody that knows more than you do.
Yeah, go find an actual living human being.
That really would be good.
And in terms of general foraging books, Judy, another listener, was wondering how to get started just on general foraging. David, do you have books? Do you look at any, or do you just use your own knowledge at this point?
I do have some books. I use the Audubon. I like that one and a couple other ones. But if I'm foraging, I've gone out with somebody, and they're just the common ones. There's really no mistake when I get them. And that's, for me, works really well.
And David, I asked you to think about ways to cook morels. How would you recommend cooking them?
You know, morels have such a great flavor. Whatever you do to them, just simply saute them, a little butter, and then serve it on top of, you know, a hamburger or some meat. Don't overpower it with anything.
Give me a good pasta dish. I mean, that sounds to me like the start of a really scrumptious and rich umami pasta.
I love it when you say umami. you make a cream sauce with a morel base so that the whole base becomes gloriously morelly, and then you put it up against some kind of pasta that doesn't fight with it.
Which pasta would fight with it?
Well, if you have something, well, we were talking before about ramp gnocchi, and that might fight with it. You want something that's going to let the morels kind of shine on their own. One time I tried making morel caramels, and I could taste the morels in there, but I felt it was a sad waste of morels, really, quite honestly, because there's so much of that kind of sugary butteriness that there was this little dark tickle in the background, but it wasn't enough to justify using those morels that way.
So you want the morel to be the center of the show?
It definitely deserves to be the center of the show.
And just something, you know, just heavy cream reduced down and adding your morels just sauteed up ahead of time and putting those in. You can add, if you add something, don't add too much. Like ramps, just add just a little bit. And, you know, Parmesan cheese also, something, you know, nutty like that also, add just a little bit to it.
That sounds wonderful.
Or even just put the Parmesan on top.
Why didn't you bring any of that? That would have been really good, David.
Yes. You got to find the morels first.
Yeah, well, that's true. We got a note from Tom in Bolton who says, my father would always find us Indian cucumber in the woods, which is delicious, but none of my friends have ever heard of it, and even a lot of the old Vermonter types. Do people know about this plant? Arthur Haynes, do you know about Indian cucumber?
Yes. It's a member of the lily family, and it has this really interesting sort of two-storied appearance with leaves and these nodding flowers and the tuber, the underground part that the caller is interested in, is this very crisp, starchy root that tastes, I mean, almost identical to a cucumber. It just has a different texture.
That sounds fabulous. And is it rare? I mean, given that none of Tom's friends have ever heard of it, is it something that's rare or just not eaten very much?
It's not rare. It's just infrequent, and in some places it can be a little bit abundant, but it's scattered all over northern New England. It's just not, you know, one of the common forest plants that everyone learns about today.
Arthur, we've been talking about recipes, and I've excluded you from this. Do you have a good recipe, whether you want to talk about morels, pheasant back mushrooms, or any of the plants that we've been talking about?
Well, I love all of the recipes that I've been hearing, and we're very partial to the wild rice that we gather here in the Northeast. Many people don't realize that wild rice is a wild food that can be gathered in abundance right here in New England. And so we really enjoy combining these other wild foods that we're speaking about today with our wild rice dishes. And that's one of the ways that we enjoy these wild foods through the season.
That sounds fabulous. And I will say I'm glad to know about how easily ramps can be over-harvested, because that's not something that I was aware of before. And in the past, when I have harvested ramp bulbs, I would recommend pickling them. They're just really nice as a sort of a side dish on your table, that nice, bright flavor, not quite as strong as something like pickled garlic would be or even a pickled onion, but really just a lovely flavor. And I second the ramp pesto idea. That's a favorite one. Robert's raising his hand now.
I just want to say, while I'm thinking about it, that everybody that is trying some wild food for the first time just should be aware that don't eat too much of it at the very beginning, because a lot of times when people think they're poisoned. They're not poisoned at all. It's just they've eaten too much of it. I mean, sometimes people are actually sensitive to different foods, and especially when it comes to mushrooms, you have to really be kind of careful. But I think the same is true with just about everything that you eat. Is it just, you know, if you find a ton of chicken to the woods or a ton of fiddleheads, which you should cook very well, by the way. That's one of the things you shouldn't be eating al dente, in my opinion. But, you know, it's just a good thing to be aware of, to have a little bit of it. Enjoy it. Have a little bit more of it. Then start sharing it with family members. If you have kids in the family,
ease them into it. David Hugo, Robert just mentioned cooking fiddleheads really well, and I think that's something that you would second. If you don't cook them too well, they kind of get slimy like okra.
Yeah, that's true. And fiddleheads have a really a flavor that, it just gets slimy. But if you cook them really well, you can cook that slime out of them. And I find that the flavors are even better when you cook them.
We got a note from Lauren Chico with the Winooski Valley Park District, who just wanted to second some ideas about over-harvesting fiddleheads. She writes, "Fiddlehead ferns in the Winooski River Valley are the most genetically diverse populations in Vermont due to the unique geographical history which allowed fiddlehead ferns to colonize here before other areas in the state. We would like to preserve the ecological stability and genetic integrity of fiddleheads by reminding park users that foraging is not allowed on Winooski Valley Park District properties, and we encourage sustainable harvesting methods elsewhere in the Winooski River Valley. We suggest that foragers please check with the landowners before going out and harvesting plants." She also shared some resources for sustainable foraging, and we'll post all of that information on our Facebook page, along with your tips for recipes. And I want to thank our guests for being with us today. David Hugo is head chef and food services director at Shelburne Farms. David, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Robert Resnick is a foraging enthusiast. He's also one of the top mushroom experts in the state. And, of course, he's the host of All the Traditions on VPR. Robert, nice to talk with you.
My pleasure.
And Arthur Haynes is a research botanist for the New England Wildflower Society and head of the Delta Institute of Natural History in Canton, Maine. We have a link to the class he'll be teaching on foraging in Queechee on May 30th. Go to vpr.net to find that. Arthur, nice to talk with you as well.
Yeah, thanks again. Bye.
And coming up, we'll learn about a new investment tool that helps connect investors with local businesses looking to raise capital through public offerings. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Small businesses that might benefit from local investments in a stock offering have struggled in the past to find a way that's legal, convenient, and profitable. But a new law has paved the way for Vermont businesses and investors to come together. And some entrepreneurs are using that new avenue as a springboard for their own investment tool. Janice Shade is the co-founder of a tool called Milk Money, and she's here now to explain it. Janice, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jane.
So maybe you could start by explaining what the problem is that you are trying to fix.
Okay, this is one that is near and dear to my heart, or maybe not so near, or dear, but definitely near, stemming back to when I had my own business about 7 years ago and trying to raise money and bumping up against the regulations that were in place at the time. When people would come to me and say, "I love your concept, I love what you're doing, can I invest in your company?" And I'd have to say, "Well, are you an accredited investor? Meaning, do you have net worth of $1 million and have an annual salary of $200,000? And most people at that point would say, no. And then I'd say, "Well, sorry, you know, legally you cannot invest in my company." So that makes it tough. It really narrows the pool of who you can ask for investment capital for your business to these angel investors who are the accredited investors.
So this new law in Vermont that passed not so long ago removes that barrier.
Exactly. So it now says that anyone, not necessarily accredited investors, we like to call them Main Street investors, can, if you are a Vermont resident, invest in a Vermont company.
Okay. And so you encountered these difficulties yourself when you were trying to raise money for your own business called True Body. What difference might it have made if you had been able to have these smaller scale investors, local investors, contribute and infuse the company with that money?
I'd like to think that I could have raised money a little bit faster, and it would have been more patient capital, as it's a term that you hear out there. When you bring on more sophisticated investors, they you know, they have certain expectations of how fast the company is going to grow. Getting money from the folks who just want to see a company grow and be successful and be around for a while and make good products have a lot different expectations of an entrepreneur. And so I'd like to think that it could have helped me to perhaps spend less time raising money and more time growing my business.
All right. So now it's legal for people like that to invest in companies like yours. What does Milk Money, this tool that you've developed, actually facilitate? I mean, why couldn't I just go do that myself?
You could. And to do that, I mean, one of the things that makes the power of this new regulation is bringing lots of small investments together. And so to do that, you have to reach a lot of people. And the new regulation allows you to go out over the web or social media and that kind of thing. So if I were going to do this just for myself, I'd probably have to at least make it, you know, a different landing page and do a lot of web work, and then also get the legal documentation around my offering document. And that can also add up to a lot of money. And not to mention, it takes a lot of time away from actually running my business. So what Milk Money is designed to do is to have the online platform where entrepreneurs can come, upload the information, put a video on about what they're trying to do, put their offering documents. We are talking with legal professionals about helping us to perhaps create legal documents that people can use on their own to customize for their offerings and not have to do a big engagement with an attorney. Hopefully keep some fees lower for them and have a lot of the background in the social media outreach. You know, that's part of what my partner Louisa and I bring to the table is helping them to prepare their campaign, how they're going to reach out to people and helping them bring helping to bring investors to the website for them.
So it's really about connecting these local investors with local businesses that need money.
Exactly. We kind of see ourselves as the meeting place and making sure that there's plenty of information up there about how it all works. We also see what we're doing as an educational opportunity for people who are interested in investing locally. Most people that might be interested in this have never done anything like it before. So we want to provide as much information as possible about how it works, about the risks, because this is certainly a risky endeavor to undertake.
Businesses can fail.
Absolutely. And, you know, I always say, you know, people should be willing to put up, I call it your going to Vegas money. This is the money, you know, check that you're going to go and put down all on red 29. And if it comes up, great. And if not, you lose it. You need to be able to think about that when you're putting your money into companies like this. You might not see it again.
Although most investors wouldn't think of their business as just sort of gambling with the house. I mean, wouldn't you think, I need to be a smart investor and I'm going to look at the businesses that I think might succeed and that's where I'm going to put my money because, yeah, it's a bet, but I think it's a good bet.
Absolutely. And part of what Louisa and I are doing is we're talking to entrepreneurs who have established businesses. So we're trying to mitigate as much as possible the risk, although we cannot guarantee in any way that a company is going to be successful. But mitigating that by working with entrepreneurs that have a track record, have some products that are out there on the shelves. You can see it. It's not just somebody who's trying to raise money and then they're going to, you know, fly off and buy an island in the South Pacific. So trying to put some of that those kind of safeguards in place as much as possible. But
you are vetting the companies.
Absolutely. And they're on our website. We are requiring that they put documentation, a business plan, not a 50-page business plan, but a reasonable business plan with financial projections, some talk about the risks and the competition and that kind of thing, full disclosure up on our website so that everyone can feel like they're getting as much information and background as they need to be able to make an informed decision.
I just want to back up very quickly to just clarify. We're not talking here about companies that are doing community-supported fundraising or a crowdsourcing campaign. These are companies that are basically doing a public offering. This is like a stock offering, right?
Yes. And, I mean, you could think of it as crowdsourcing because we're trying to bring lots of people to it. But we are talking about people actually being able to own the company. It's not like a Kickstarter where you're making a donation or maybe you get a t-shirt or, you know, some kind of tchotchke. This is about participating in the financial success of the company you're giving your money to.
So the reason, or one of the reasons why you're calling this Milk Money, is tied to the first company that you're really pushing out there and promoting. People who fly through Burlington Airport may have seen these lactation pods in the terminal, the lactation pod. It's created by a Burlington company called Mamava. You are the CFO of that company, right?
Right.
So you are launching Mamava through this service that people can invest in, and that's going to help the company expand?
Absolutely. Yes, it's exciting to be able to use Mamava as the platform for launching Milk Money. And Sasha, one of the co-founders of Mamava, is really excited about this whole concept because she's had people come to her and say, I love your business. Can I invest in it? I live right down the road from you. So it's making those connections happen, neighbors supporting neighbors. And so we're excited to get that launched in the next couple weeks.
That's Janice Shade. She's the co-founder, along with Louisa Shibley, of the new local investment tool called Milk Money. Shade is the CFO of a lactation pod business called Mamava. We were just talking about it. It's the first company to be promoted through this tool. Janice, thanks very much for sharing it with us.
Thanks very much for letting me tell about it.
All right. Outward migration from Vermont is not a new concept, but a study conducted by a team of researchers sheds new light on why people leave the state, why others stay, and why some make their way back. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll hear from two of the study's authors and learn what role landscape and cultural diversity play in the movement of Vermonters. Send your questions or comments, share your own experience with us. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen. We have production assistants from Devin Karambolis and Amanda Shepherd. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.